This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So some of you may be old enough to have seen this film, but I will describe it just generally. One of my favorite comedians, Peter Sellers, starred in a movie called Being There many years ago. And basically, the story is that in Being There, Peter Sellers plays a few bricks shy of the wall, and he's the gardener for this old man who eventually dies. And he's lived at this old man's house since he was a little boy taking care of the garden, because that's all he can actually be trusted to do. And there's a cook there who always makes sure that he's fed. And the thing that he loves the most is watching TV. And so in every room of this old house, there's a TV. And when he is not gardening, that is what he is doing. He's got a remote, and he flips the channels over and over and over. So at some point, the master of the house dies. And he doesn't have any clue. He goes and he sees him, and it's not registering because he's not all there. The cook is leaving, and she's like, you have to leave now. He's like, leave? He doesn't know what that means. And she's like, I don't know what's going to happen to you. So eventually what happens is he goes to his master's room. He finds one of his suits, very fancy suit, that fits him. He finds his suitcase. He packs a few belongings, which, by the way, includes one of the small televisions. And he walks out. And on the way, it turns out that this house has gone from being in a really nice neighborhood to being in a really bad neighborhood. But that because he lived inside with his master all the time, and his master was getting older and older, he never went outside in the front, so he didn't know. So he's walking through this terrible neighborhood wearing this very fancy outfit with a briefcase that's made out of leather. So he looks like someone of real wealth and authority. So there's a gang on the street, and they immediately start to chivy him. And, you know, hey, man, what's going on? What are you doing here? Oh, what's in the bag? And he's like a babe in the woods. And then they start to say, oh, are you here for you know, Carlos? And Carlos, did he send you and put you in all and put you up to this? And like, you tell Carlos for me that, you know, if he wants to speak to me, he should come and speak to me. Meanwhile, the Peter Sellers character is just like, he walks along until he starts coming into the larger city. And what ends up happening is, he walks between two cars that are parked on the street. One of them is a very fancy limousine. And the driver is talking to a woman who gets in the back, and he starts forward. And the Peter Sellers character gets caught in between. The driver, of course, is like, oh my God, gets out. The woman in the car gets out. What's going on? Oh my God. And of course, again, she sees how he is dressed. She sees the briefcase. Oh my God, are you hurt? Are you okay? Oh, we need to get him to a doctor right now. And then, because of the way he responds, he seems a little out of it. She says, yeah, what is your name? Chance the Gardener. Throughout the entire film, everybody misunderstands, and they think he's saying Chauncey Gardner. So they think, you know, Chauncey, very old-fashioned name, and really it's just Chance the Gardener. He's been named Chance because he showed up by chance. But he's now Chauncey the Gardener to this woman, Chauncey Gardner, and she thinks, oh my God, I have just hurt a really important person. She says, forget it, we're not going to the hospital. It doesn't appear that anything, we're taking him directly to my house. The whole rest of the film is about how everybody makes this mistake based on these really simplistic statements that he makes. The statements about the garden. I work the garden. And they're all thinking he's speaking in metaphor. Whoa, the garden, right? I take care of the garden. And he starts saying, I mean, it turns out that the house is the home of a senator who has the ear of the president. All of these people end up meeting Chance the Gardener as Chauncey Gardener. And everything he says becomes a statement of wisdom. He says, just till the garden and all will be well. Or, a garden takes time and has its seasons, fall and winter, which are times to replenish and rest. Spring and summer are times of growth. Weeding and pruning the dead wood must be done to make way for new growth. The president is listening to all this. He's in deep dew in his presidency, and he's thinking that this guy is saying, you got to get rid of the dead wood in your government. And things look not so great right now, but give it some time. Spring will come and everything will be well. So it just goes from bad to worse. A doctor has been brought in and he's like a little suspicious. But at the very end, after the senator is also very ill and he dies, finally the doctor turns to him and says, so you really are a gardener, aren't you? Oh, yes, says the Peter Sellers character. But in the meantime, the entire government has changed because of this. I tell you this because, in some sense, the metaphor is true. We are all gardeners. We are all seeding ourselves. We are planting. We are watering. We are weeding. You know, if you take a look up above, there's a whole new, beautiful, little tiny field of clover that got seeded and got watered. And now it's grown and it looks beautiful. But that's us. But what are we seeding? What are we putting in this good earth that is our life? Are we taking the time to see what's actually thriving in our life and what is not? What are we doing? Maybe, you know, there are plants in my garden that I have noticed you're not doing so well here. I need to move you. And then there are other plants that, when they have found their spot, my Matilia poppy is bigger than it has ever been. It loves where it is, and I would never move it. But I have a fuchsia that is extremely unhappy. And this is the case for us. Maybe we're in a job where we are not thriving. We're in the corner wilting because someone is not watering us. Or the soil is not deep enough, or the seeds we planted of what we wanted from that job are not happening. So, I was talking to a student who was saying that she was looking, she was weeding something, and only discovered after digging out what she thought was the mother root that there were all these other roots going in different places and that she might need a bigger shovel. And I said, you know, when I first started planting my 40-year-old garden, there were so many different kinds of weeds, and they came up every year with alarming regularity. Half the summer was just spent weeding. I finally realized that I needed to weed before these plants went to seed rather than afterwards, that helped a lot. Some weeds still ended up coming, but over time I pulled them out, and then the amount of weeding started to decrease. Until finally, last year, I began to notice that the areas, the walking areas between the planted areas, there were no weeds coming up at all. It took me a while to notice, oh, wow, there used to be weeds here all the time. What has changed? Huh. Well, the only remaining weeds are a species of broom and false broom that are unfortunately all over these hills that have come from other places, and we are all fighting those. But I can keep them off my own property at least. And on the property next to me, which is sort of uninhabited, I can work on it a little bit. But they're always these invasive species of our lives. They're always sort of lurking around the edges. Rather than getting out your shovel, a hand trowel sometimes is a very useful thing for the little daily weeds of one of the poisons that Buddhism talks about. Desire, thirsting desire, the poison of craving, of wanting. We want something all the time. And some of those wants are fine. You know, the desire, for instance, to come here and practice, that's healthy. But some of the desires in our life are not so much. And they're harmful, first of all, to us, but then they might start being harmful to the people around us. So for the cravings in your life that are invasive and then really harmful, well, those are the ones that we sometimes indulge in or we suffer from. And the only thing that you can do in that case is to be your own Chauncey Gardener. You keep your own garden clear. And you don't worry about getting all the way to the bottom of it because you're probably going to be working on it the rest of your life. So I've talked about this before. In my case, I'm in the poison of the middle one of aversion. So anger arises for me, irritation, annoyance, and I dig away. I do. But the root goes very deep. And sometimes I think I've gotten the root, and actually all I've gotten is the upper part of it, but there's still something down there that I have to keep going to. And I'm probably going to be doing that the rest of my life, and that's okay. It's a good way to spend the rest of your life, getting to the bottom of your craving and your delusion and your aversion. So here's the thing, though. What I really wanted to talk about today is rather than concentrating on your craving, which is about what we don't have, right? All the things I want are the things I actually feel like I don't have right now. Can we instead turn our attention to what we do have? Could we grow a garden in our life of abundance and reciprocity? Relationships and interconnection. We talked about it this morning in the Metta Sutta, you know. Even as a mother, at the risk of her own life, will take care of her child, will give up anything in herself to take care of that child. For us to have that attitude for others is amazing. There is a saying in Zen practice that the best gifts are the ones given in stealth. I have enjoyed this many years. I love this one. I love leaving a vase of flowers for someone with no note, just on their doorstep, a neighbor, or some food that I made an extra container of that I know would make their life simpler, or just actually sending a birthday card once a year I have a birthday list that's over 300 people long. So you can imagine I'm making a lot because I make my cards. I make a lot of cards. But this is my way once a year to say, I'm thinking about you and I love you and I want you to know that. It's a small thing, but it's something that I can do, right? So the writer Margaret Atwood said, every time a gift is given, it is enlivened and regenerated through the new spiritual life it engenders, both in the giver and the recipient. It's a double gift. First of all, I get the gift of the joy of, oh boy, I make a whole bunch of cards. And then I sit there and think, I have a list of all the August birthdays. So and so should get this one. Oh, and this one's definitely. I get to choose which of the cards. I don't think about it in advance, but it just sort of happens. Oh, that's the perfect card for this person. So I get the joy of creation and of choosing, what am I going to send? And then they get the joy of receiving. And everybody is always surprised. How do you do this? I get this card from you every year. It's like, I have a list. It's not that complicated. So I started thinking about abundance versus scarcity. We have a culture that encourages a model of scarcity, what we don't have. But this little book, The Service Berry, is written by the same person who wrote it, wrote Braiding Sweetgrass. She's an Indigenous woman who writes about simplicity. And in this book, The Economics of Abundance. It's a wonderful book. I'm only going to quote a few small parts. I highly recommend it. So, in thinking about this giving and receiving, this reciprocity, which is actually about abundance and scarcity, we have to consider economics. And I'm not just talking about money or even bartering, although she talks a lot about that in here. The economics of life, the economics of relationship. So at some point near the beginning, Robin, the author, says, what is economics for anyway? The American Economic Association says it's the study of scarcity, the study of how people use resources and respond to incentives, which means that anything and everything in a market is implicitly defined as scarce. Think about this for a second. With scarcity as the main principle, the mindset that follows is based on a commodification of all goods and services. It's the same problem that we have with the economics of jobs. In Burma in the old days, before it got changed to Myanmar, it was considered absolutely essential that everyone have a job. Everyone. There was no unemployment because there were jobs at all levels of society. And the job of the soil night cleaner and the job of the king were equal in dignity. It was more important to have dignity in the country than it was to have unemployment, which pushes other jobs up. The thing about capitalism is that you absolutely need to have unemployment so that you have competition for jobs. It's a fundamental point, very different. One is all about people and dignity and honor. And the ability to do something. And the other is completely about money and the bottom line. And oh, you don't have a job? Oh, too bad. Oh, you can't buy food then? Oh, gee, that's a pity. You have no dignity because work, we have a funny way with work. We think work is kind of a bad thing, Work is what gives us purpose. It gives honor. We can do any kind of work beautifully if we come to it with that attitude. So unfortunately, this, the economics of scarcity, is a mindset of separation rather than this. It is about getting mine first and, oh, too bad for the rest of you. This is not our practice, by the way. But then there's another person, Dr. Valerie Lousadas, who is for the U.S. Society for Ecological Economics. Don't you love that? Ecological economics, I agree. And she defines economics as how we organize ourselves to sustain life and enhance its quality. It is a way of considering how we provide for ourselves. It's about relationship. She goes on to say, Robin, gift economies are another way of organizing ourselves to sustain life. In a gift economy, wealth is understood as having enough to share. And the practice for dealing with abundance is to give it away. In fact, status is actually determined not by how much you accumulate, but by how much you can give away. The currency in a gift economy is relationship, which is expressed as gratitude and interdependence and the ongoing cycle of reciprocity. When I went to Japan and stayed there for 6 weeks in a monastery, at the end, I had been advised by my teacher here, you need to leave in a nice envelope, a 100 yen note on the altar. You don't tell anybody, you just leave it on the altar, make a bow. I was down to my last 100 yen, thinking to myself, how am I getting home from here? I had a bank card. I didn't know if the train station was going to accept it, but, you know, my teacher had said I needed to leave that 100 yen note, so I did. The teacher at this center decided that rather than send me off by bus to the Shinkansen, the train, the bullet train, he would drive me himself. Oh, and then I get to the train station. And he orders a bento box for me for my lunch on the train and hands me an envelope. Inside the envelope is 100 yen. It was not the same envelope, by the way. He hadn't seen that yet. I was blown away. This is it. It's just cyclical. You give, you take. You give, you take. Or receive, actually, better word. She goes on to say, if we think of the earth as a big warehouse of commodities, as mere objects, and I'm talking about the trees, the rocks, the land, the wheat that grows on it. If we just think of that as the big warehouse of commodities, we claim a kind of privilege to exploit what we believe that we own. So I recently read a story where I think it's SpaceX is going to send a rocket to crash into the moon. We don't own the moon. Who gave SpaceX permission to crash a rocket into it? It's bizarre thinking. And it's probably going to happen. Anyway, she says, in that property mindset, how we consume doesn't really matter because it's just stuff. And the stuff all belongs to us. There's no moral constraint on consumption. And so we find ourselves in a time of ecological and spiritual depletion. We go to other countries and we say, you have a source of lithium. Great. We're going to buy all this land up and we're going to hire your people But we're going to make this big hole in the ground. And when we've taken all your lithium, well, bye, have a nice life. And did we pay the price, the actual price of the lithium? Probably not. Did we actually pay the price of the human labor? Probably not. It's all just stuff, and stuff belongs to us. The mountains, the rivers, the redwoods, whoever gets there first and has the might to do it takes it. Without constraint on consumption, moral or legal, right? There is nothing to stop us from depleting this world. And when we deplete this world, we deplete ourselves. This world is a gift that we were given. We don't know who the giver was, but we need to honor it. And instead, we use it like it belonged to us from the very beginning, and nothing belongs to us. I live 20 minutes down the road in the middle of Redwoods. When I bought that house, I bought a house. I didn't buy the redwoods on that property. It's 3.5 acres of redwoods. They don't belong to me. I've never felt that way. A couple times some have come down and I've had to branch them or things like that, but they don't belong to me. I'm merely the steward for as long as I'm on that land. And I trust and hope that others believe that too. I know that's the way it is viewed here at Jikoji. This land doesn't belong to us. It didn't even belong to the original indigenous people. And they understood that. And so they took care of it as we are taking care of it. She goes on to say, she asks, what would it be like to consume with the full awareness that we are the recipients of earthly gifts, which we have not earned? To consume with some kind of humility? To harvest honorably, with restraint, with respect, with reverence, with reciprocity? Abundance thinking is ultimately about what we call in Buddhism emptiness. It is not just empty like a wastebasket, but it is empty of something. Everything is empty of something. And what is it empty of? A permanent, abiding, unchanging nature. There is not a thing you can think of that qualifies as permanent, abiding, and unchanging, except possibly impermanence. From the moment you walked in today, you are different than when you woke up this morning. You're different for many reasons. You're different because of what you had for breakfast, right? You're different because of how long you had to drive and how stressful it was or not. You're different from just sharing the same air in this room because, believe it or not, the air that you're breathing in, someone else is breathing out, right? When did it become yours? When did it stop being somebody else's? The understanding that everything is connected and relies on everything else. You can't be in this world without trees. Because the trees take your CO2 that you're breathing out and convert it into something that you actually need, oxygen. And yet, what are we doing in the rainforest? There will come a time when the balance between how much the rainforest can put oxygen into the world and the amount that the population increases needing, it's getting close. We're getting out of balance. Everything is connected and relies on everything else. That understanding is the opposite of scarcity thinking, which is about falling into the delusion of separation and I'm here, I'm doing my thing, and the rest of you are on your own. Getting mine first without realizing that the very people that you're saying, well, you're on your own, are you. Some of you might not know each other in this room. I don't know a lot of you. Doesn't matter. We are fundamentally connected. And the longer you do this practice, the more you begin to feel that and experience it and know it deep inside. So a master in our lineage, Dogen Zenji, wrote a whole thesis called The Eight Awakenings of Human Beings. The first two of the eight. The first one is have few desires. We talked about that in the Metta Sutta this morning too. Live a frugal life. Right? We can all do this. But the second one I love, know how much is enough. I'm in the process of moving, and other people I know are also in the process of moving. And some of my very elder friends moved even though they didn't want to. What is absolutely stunning is that even though I'm somebody, I walk around my house at least once a year and go, have I looked at that? Have I used that? Have I read that? Have I needed that? Have I appreciated it? Because if the answer is no, out it goes. I either give it away or I take it to one of the donation centers to let someone else have the value of it. Even so, it is stunning how much stuff we all have. My husband has a box in the attic that he hasn't looked at probably 15 or 20 years when it first got shipped to him, of his Lionel train set from when he was eight. And his mother 20 years ago finally said, I need to send this to you, or you need to take it with you. And I keep saying, honey, what are you going to do about the Lionel train set? Because we are not taking it with us. Oh, yeah. I said, look, I have the perfect kid right now who is train crazy. And we could give it. This is the grandson of one of my dearest friends. We could give them to him. Oh, I don't know. They're really valuable. You know, they should be sold. Fine, then sell them. But it's a box this big. When was the last time you even opened it? How many of you have a Lionel train set in your attic somewhere of some kind? If you're honest, you know you've got something that you haven't looked at, that you really, you're keeping it for what, sentimental reasons? Someday I'm going to have a Christmas tree and I'm going to lay the Lionel train out and run it? No, you aren't. A few years ago, I had to clear out the house, a three-story condominium, or townhouse, I guess, of a friend who it turned out was a hoarder. I spent a year clearing that house. The books all went one place, or two places. The Ikebana equipment, I had to find someone who did Ikebana. I cannot tell you, it floor to ceiling, every room. You couldn't move into some rooms. You had to pull things out by the door first. And I said to myself, no one needs this much stuff. But I understood it. This was a person who had been a refugee from the war in Vietnam. Her whole model, and the model of many Vietnamese refugees, was scarcity. Of course it was, because they came from a land in war. Most of us are not that way. And yet in this country, every time I open my mailbox, there's a catalog. You want this? Oh, you know, oh, do you need anything? This catalog has all the stuff you might want. Or you're driving down the freeway, big billboard. If you would only buy our software, or you would buy this new car, or you would, you know, go to Costco or what, you will be happy. No, you won't. Because you're going to bring it home and you're going to say to yourself, oh no, why did I bring this? I've already got three of them. Have few or fewer desires. You will find the less desires you have for things, actually, the less cluttered your life is and the happier you become. But you have to do number two of knowing how much is enough. So there's a wonderful Tibetan Buddhist that I follow online named David Michie. He wrote a great book called The Dalai Lama's Cat. It's a fiction, it's hilarious, but a lot of wonderful Buddhist teachings in it. I read it to the kids in my Dharma school for years. Anyway, he says, you know, in Buddhism, we often speak about realization. A realization isn't simply understanding an idea. It's when an insight becomes so vivid that it changes how we naturally behave. Much of the Buddhist path isn't about accumulating knowledge. It's about allowing truths to sink deeply enough into our hearts to transform them. It makes us wonder then, what is the point of being rich if we never actually feel rich? What is the point of having leisure if we experience only stress and busyness and exhaustion, which is, from my place, what so many young people are experiencing in the work environment? They are really stressed out, and I think they have good reason to be. You know, I thought it was a big deal during COVID as the pandemic coordinator for my school that I was working 70 to 80 hours a week trying to keep everyone safe. But what I'm hearing is that young people in jobs are being expected to work 70 hours a week now. They're expected to work on Saturday and or Sunday. This is not good for you. You know, the Industrial Revolution scared the you-know-what out of everybody, partly because there were all these machines that were hacking off hands and people were getting caught in them, but partly because of the expectations that everything had to start going much faster, more efficiently. It's much worse now. I am so glad that I am retired from that stuff, and that the job I had of teaching young children was a lot less stressful than working in the computer industry or the retail industry or government. Just for those of you who can remember even 10 years ago, the amount of information we are taking in now every single day has exploded. It's overwhelming. That's not good for us. Our work, the work we're doing here, the work we do on our cushion, is to come from a place of abundance, shifting our needs away from whatever is in short supply, and instead thinking, well, if there's not enough out there of what I want, then maybe I could want something else. What an idea. The real outcome of abundance thinking rather than scarcity thinking is exactly what we long for but can never purchase, which is being valued for our unique gifts, earning the regard of our friends, our family, our neighbors, for the quality of our character, not the quantity of our possessions or the size of our bank account or the beautiful car we own. It's what you give, not what you have, that makes you a delightful, happy human being. Because remember, we do not practice for enlightenment. we practice as an expression of our actual true nature. And that nature is filled with abundance and gratitude. I am very grateful you are all here today. Thank you. And I have no clock, Ino-san.
You have 1 minute.
1 minute. Anybody got a 1 minute question? Anything? Doesn't have to be about what I was talking about.
Yes. Here.
Akbar, yes.
Yes. Thank you very much for the insightful talk. I really enjoyed it. I have a couple of quick comments and a question. One is that the SpaceX thing already crashed into the moon. So that was a
too late for that.
Well, that was a few days ago. And also, I remember once seeing, I'm old enough to have seen that movie, being there. And one of the scenes on the street, when he was being harassed by that gang, he thought that he was watching a TV channel and started changing the,
right,
trying to change the.
He had his remote.
Yes, right. He was just clicking it and it wasn't changing.
I'd forgotten that. Thank you. That's a great little detail because he couldn't distinguish reality from the TV.
Exactly. And the question is that you were talking about the weeds in your garden. My question is that, is there any way that we can coexist with the weeds? Because they are part of our environment and they probably have been here before us. They've been here a long, long time ago. Is there a way to, you know, coexist peacefully with them? How do we deal with it?
That's a great question, both in reality and in metaphor. I'll deal with the reality first, which is that if I allow the weeds the same amount of space as the plants I'm trying to cultivate, the plants I'm trying to cultivate will lose. Because invasive species, the one that's down here now, the false brome, sits at the base of redwoods and sucks up all the moisture from them. So there are some weeds that are not supposed to be here. They come from other places.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones that we need to work with. Metaphorically, though, of course, we all have weeds. My weed is anger, right? I'm always working on it. But at some point, you're right, I have to accept I came by this anger, you know, honestly, because I had angry parents and I have angry siblings. And I don't know that my siblings are working on it, but one day my brother, he thought he was being funny in an email, kind of baiting me. And I didn't rise to it at all. And he wrote back, he said, "Wow, this meditation thing must be working." And I was like, "What do you mean? I didn't even get it." And he says, "Well, normally you would have gotten upset." And I said, "Well, why would you want to do something like that then?" "Oh, because it's so much fun to see people get upset." So some people actually, and hopefully all of us, would like to work with those internal weeds. And the way to do that is to accept that they're there without feeling badly about them, right? But that doesn't, as Suzuki Roshi once said famously, "You are already perfect and there is still room for self-improvement." So we have all of these things and we work on them, but we realize we don't need a shovel, right? We're not trying to change ourselves overnight. A little trowel will do, a little bit at a time. And we'll probably be working on it for the rest of our gardening life.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to point out that we actually have Jikoji's basic garden person online, and I wondered if she wanted to add a response. Jackie's here. She was just here reading for like 8 hours in the hot sun yesterday.
Tell us why you did that.
Oh, I've been thinking a lot about the land and the plants that are growing on it. Invasive species, we generally, humans, brought them with us and upset the balance of nature wherever we go. And it's a huge conundrum. But now I'm dealing with this other problem, as many people are, in my home, because I, like you, live on a property. It's about 3 acres. I have chaparral on one side, redwoods on another side. and I'm living on our road with 22 other houses on it. We're now a firewise community, which means that we keep our vegetation down so that in the event of a wildfire, we might be able to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Some people in my neighborhood, they scalp everything. They scalp everything up to their house, and this disturbs me a lot. However, I don't do much of anything, and I feel bad about that too. It's like I don't know that there's any balance here. Because, you know, chaparral is a wonderful ecosystem. There are little creatures that live in my piece of chaparral their whole lives. And I have to thin it. You can't really thin chaparral. It turns into something else. It turns into oak woodland. You know, so I sit constantly with these conundrums, and I cannot really find peace or a place to rest. If I leave, someone else will turn this place into a vineyard, probably. And also, I have family that lives with me here. So I have a hard time finding a place to rest. So I come to Jokoji.
Well, I completely empathize, because when PG&E comes to our neighborhood, they want to create a scalped environment about 10 feet square around every pole. So they take it down to bare earth in places where it's going to cause a slide. And I keep talking, you know, can't we just have something very low? No, they come in, completely raise it to the ground. So I deal with that too. And all I can say is, from the point of view of practice, we're always walking that tightrope, right? Of too much or too little, right? Either too much self-concern or too much not taking care of yourself while you're busy taking care of others, right? There's always this conundrum of trying to find that middle way. I mean, I really do believe that the Buddha understood that that was the biggest problem. He called it the middle way for that reason. Right? How do we find that place? And, you know, between self and other, between scalping and knowing that you have creatures that live in these. I mean, I have two cypress trees that got planted before I ever bought this house, and there's hundreds of birds that live in it. The cypress is not a native tree, but I'm not going to cut it down either, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to make choices. And we hope, one of the reasons that we sit is that we hope with some clarity that comes from the sitting, eventually we come to some good decision. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
And thank you all for being here again.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.